the Joint House and Senate Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome to our inaugural run, everybody. And I think the amendments are being copied as we speak. And the first order of business is going to be to adopt the rules of the Joint Committee. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee rules. We'll put an organizational meeting.
Organizational meeting opening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The rules before you are rules that are based on and patterned after the traditional joint committee rules that are used by the Ways and Means Committee. These rules provide for the normal. As is the case with a joint committee, typically to move anything out of committee or to approve a motion requires a majority of both the senators and a majority of the House members of the committee. One other, as is the case with all the rules of session, we have to have printed amendments in front of us, take action on amendments and fiscal and revenue statements in order to make to move a measure to the floor. For any amendments that we have, and as is the case with joint committees, typically, the rest of the rules are typical of joint committees.
Thank you. So, do I have a motion to adopt the rules?
We adopt the rules, Madam Chair.
Representative Schaffler has moved to adopt the rules. Discussion. Seeing none, any objections? I'm not quite sure. Is it?
You're fine.
Okay. The rules have been adopted. All right. And so I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2001A. And Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have about a 35-sentence summary of this measure, so I will dispense with reading the summary of the measure and simply say that this measure has been before the House Transportation Committee and the House Revenue Committee. It is the transportation funding package for the 2009 session. You have before you a copy of the staff measure summary for that, as well as the fiscal and revenue analysis on the A and gross version, which is what was moved out of the House Transportation Committee. In your packets, you also have a letter from the chair of the Revenue Committee with a few comments based on the hearing that the House Revenue Committee had on this on Tuesday, as well as testimony from Environment Oregon, and Fitzgerald, Walt Childress, and I believe that's what's in your packets.
Thank you, Patrick. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and call up Heidi Altmaier, who has offered to do a very brief walkthrough of the sections, and hopefully by the time we get partway through, we'll have an actual amendment that we're looking at and that you will be able to look at. And welcome, Heidi.
Good evening, Chair Metzger and Chair Beyer. My name is Heidi Altmaier, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I am here today to walk you through the 70-section bill, starting with Section 1.
Yeah,
Section 1 is, if you've seen the Dash 17s, is actually the same as the Dash 17. And what it does is directs the House and Senate Interim Committees to conduct studies to view best practices for involvement in transportation decision-making, and identify opportunities to achieve greater program efficiency, and then come back to the legislature to prepare legislation to implement the recommendations. Section 3 will implement congestion pricing in the Portland metropolitan area. It does not permit the congestion pricing pilot program to apply to heavy vehicles, so those vehicles over 26,000 pounds. That pilot program will sunset in the year 2016. Going on to Section 5. Section 5 directs the Travel Information Council to manage and operate just a few of the best areas along I-5 and 84. It would also permit them to issue permits to folks who want to raise money for their nonprofit organizations by providing coffee and cookies at the rest areas. And those are in Section 5 and 6 of the Dash 23 amendment.
It's a Dash 23.
No, sorry. I believe so. Oh, sorry. I got ahead of myself. Section 5 is the website. The website will have all the projects that will be funded as a result of the revenues raised by this bill. And the website will contain the contracts and all the project descriptions, and it must be updated weekly by the department. Is about least cost planning. Section 7 is the issuance of lottery bonds, also known as the Connect Oregon. It also gives money to rural airports that can be matched with federal funds. Section 12 is the medium speed electric vehicle, defines what a vehicle is. In section 13, we talk about where a person may operate one of these electric speed vehicles and the offense of operating on a highway where they're not supposed to be operating. Section 14 directs the department to adopt safety standards for the low speed electric vehicles. Section 15 is about co-location of facilities for the department. Section 17 directs the Oregon Transportation Commission to work with stakeholders to update and their statewide transportation improvement program criteria. Section 18 directs the department to adopt rules regarding environmental standards. Section 19 directs the department to implement transportation design practices that follow the concept of practical design. And says that practical design standards should incorporate maximum flexibility in the application of standards that reduce the cost of project delivery while also preserving and enhancing safety and mobility. Section 21. This is to direct the department to generate alternatives to improve safety on at least one county road that is used to carry hazardous materials in lieu of using a state highway. Now we're at TIC, the rest areas. I believe. No, we're not. We're at asset management.
Not resting yet.
I'm just so excited about the rest areas. Section 23 directs the department to undertake a pilot project to contract out all maintenance activities on a segment of state highway that is at least 10 miles in length, but not more than 30 miles. It directs the department to prepare plans and implement the contracts no later than June 1st, 2010. Section 25 places a moratorium on local governments from imposing a local gas tax. You also find what's important is to also pay attention to Section 70, which grandfathers in those local governments that already currently have an ordinance that imposes the gas tax. Section 27 requires that local governments starting in 2014 may impose a gas tax, but only after voter approval. Section 29 says that car rental companies may not impose in a rental agreement a surcharge for the purpose of covering the cost of titling and registering vehicles that is greater than the actual cost of registering and titling those vehicles. Section 30 directs staff to create a new study called the Efficient Fee Study. This is in addition to the current highway cost allocation study to consider the actual cost users impose on the highway system, including but not limited to highway replacement costs, transportation congestion costs, and the cost of gas emissions. Section 31 establishes the Urban Trail Fund. Monies in the fund are to be used for developing and maintaining multi-use trails within the urban growth boundaries for non-motorized vehicles and for pedestrians. To provide links to road, highways, footpaths, and bicycle trails. Finally, Section 32, rest area. I think we covered them.
You can take a breath now. Okay.
Section 35 directs the Department of Transportation and the Travel Information Council to work with the private sector to develop a plan for installing electric motor vehicle recharging stations at roadside rest areas operated by the council or the department. The department and the council shall jointly report to the House and interim committees on transportation and the development of the plan. Sections 38 long. It's about planning and land use planning and transportation planning within Metro. It requires Metro to also report to the department. And we also ask that the Metropolitan Planning Organization in the Eugene Springfield area also engage in planning. Section 41. Amendment 801041, the statute currently permits counties to impose registration fees if counties receive voter approval. The amendment to the statute would permit a county with a population of 350 or more to enact an ordinance to impose registration fees without voter approval, but for the specific purpose of designing and constructing a bridge across the Willamette River. In the next section, 801041 is amended again to say that in 2013, counties population of 350,000 or more may enact an ordinance that permits them to impose a county registration fee, but those under 350,000 must get voter approval as they do now in current statute. Section 43 increases the fees for titling. Section 44 increases some of the fees for vehicle registration fees. Section 45 increases some of the plate fees. And you will see later on that all this money that I just mentioned is actually being dedicated to projects that are mentioned in, I believe, Section 65. So we will be getting there. 805-250, Section 46, increases the vanity plate fee, and that money goes towards passenger rail. Section 47 increases the identification card fee. Section 49 increases the gas tax by 6 cents. The gas tax increase, it does not go into effect unless there has been an increase of at least 2% each quarter for two or more consecutive quarters in the last 12 months. Seasonally adjusted non-farm payroll employment or January 1st, 2011, whichever should come first. You will see blanks in the next three sections, 52, 53, and 54. These blanks will be filled in tonight after I receive the numbers from legislative revenue. The purpose of the blanks, the Constitution requires that the light vehicles and the heavy vehicles share cost responsibility. And now that we know what the light vehicles will be paying, we can figure out what the heavy vehicles are going to be paying. Section 57 is the section I was referring to earlier. This is the section that describes where all that money is going and how it's going to be allocated. 50% of that money, some of that money will go to the Department of Transportation, and $3 million will go to the Travel Information Council for the rest areas. But the rest of it, 50% will go to the department, 30% will go to counties, and 20% will go to the city. That section is double amended to prevent the gas tax is enacted in 2011 or earlier if our economy approves. Section 62, the highway user bonds. It permits issuance of bonds in the amount of $840 million. Section 63 permits the use of the monies otherwise used for bond debt service that's not necessarily needed right away to do other projects. Section 65. Probably the most interesting to everyone in this room is what all that money is going to be used for. This lays out all of the projects. Section 66 and 67 are just legal language for a bond council. Section 68A and 68B, the diesel engine tax credits, also found in House Bill 2067. Section 68 is the extension of the sunset for the pay-as-you-drive insurance. And finally, this bill will take effect 91 days after sunny day.
Thank you. Appreciate all your hard work over the last 4 or 5 months on this, and it always seems like it's all at once. It's never just a little bit at a time, but you've done a great job. We really appreciate your work, and most of the rest of the questions, I think the rest of us are going to probably have to answer if the committee has questions. So thank you for coming, and again, we really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
All right. And committee, is there any, are we ready to move into the testimony at this point? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and call up Deborah Kofori and Lynn Peterson. Welcome, and we don't want to be here all night, and so we're going to kind of watch the time, and if people start starting getting a little long, we'll pull the timer out, but welcome.
Thank you, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Kofori, and I'm a Multnomah County Commissioner. We are here today to strongly support this package and to applaud your work in crafting a bill that addresses the needs, the transportation needs of our region. As a former member of this body, I know all too well that all this hard work leaves some winners and some losers, but I have to say that overall, I think you guys have done a commendable job with this package. And I specifically want to highlight the critical provisions of the bill that will assist our county in replacing the Selwood Bridge. As many of you know, the Selwood Bridge carries more than 30,000 vehicles a day, making it Oregon's busiest two-lane bridge. But after 80 years, the bridge has reached the point where it needs to be replaced. The Selwood Bridge has a federal sufficiency rating of 2 out of 100. In comparison, the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis that collapsed in 2007 had a federal sufficiency rating of 50. Multnomah County is working closely with our partners at the City of Portland and Clackamas County on the Selwood Bridge project, and we anticipate beginning construction on this project in the next 2 years. We have worked extensively with the public in the planning process in establishing a locally preferred alternative plan and with significant public support for replacing this bridge. Again, thank you for the work on this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. And Lynn.
Good evening, chairs, and I'm sorry, I was going to say commissioners. my representatives, my name is Lynn Peterson, and I'm the chair of the Clackamas County Commission. And coming down here was a good example of the taxes, the taxing on our system in terms of the load, trying to get out of downtown Portland and then through Salem on the first day of such a long weekend. So my heart rate is still high from running into the building. This is a good first step in meeting local maintenance and preservation needs, and I just want to thank everybody on this committee for working on the compromises that you have. It will also help with some limited capital improvements, which we very much appreciate. One of the things that I do want to talk about is that as amended, many elements are the result of those long negotiations, and one of the areas that has been the most challenging is regarding climate change and the environment. And while it's not perfect, and certainly we can do some more hard work in the future coming up, we do have some wins, and there is multimodal improvements, which is significantly going to help every part of the state, whether the elderly, senior and elderly, or just adding capacity to the system. We have a significant investment in bike and peds, a pilot project to implement congestion pricing, which will be very helpful to look at how things will work on transportation demand management, some environmental performance standards, and least cost planning, which is probably my favorite. What I would like to ask you for is to really pass this bill out and just urge you to vote for the bill. One of the things that we're going to need to work on in the future, though, is the future of transportation and where it's going, and so I look forward to working with you on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Committee? Seeing none. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Leslie Lewis and Ted Crawford.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I am Leslie Lewis. I'm one of the three Yamhill County Commissioners, and I bring you today a message from all three County Commissioners. We are unanimously in support of House Bill 2001, and I'm going to just be brief, but clearly this is an important package for the infrastructure needs of the state of Oregon, and it is greatly going to help the county road system, and we really appreciate that. And we really appreciate the recognition of the Newburgh-Dundee bypass, as well as other projects of statewide significance. We note that there's other important projects like the Sunrise Corridor and Oregon 62 that are also on the list of projects of statewide significance. We believe that you have done a great job selecting projects and making sure that they are funded to completion. And you are definitely making very good strategic infrastructure investments throughout the state of Oregon. And finally, I'd just like to say this definitely will create jobs. We had WorkSource Oregon through the Oregon Employment Department do an analysis for us on how many jobs will be created for construction for the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass Phase 1. And the estimate is that 865 jobs total will be created over about a 2 or 3 year period for construction. So we thank you for that and thank you for your efforts, and I would take any questions.
Go ahead.
Ten. Chair Beyer and Chair Metzger, I'm Ted Crawford. I'm a member of the City Council of the City of Dundee, and I'm just here to extend my gratefulness of including the Dundee Bypass as a project in this HB 2001, and I reiterate everything Commissioner Lewis said, and again, I'm very grateful for you including the project.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? No. Thank you for coming. Oh, this ought to go fast, right? Famous last words, right? Ken and Joanne Austin and Cheryl Kelch, if you want to I'll come up together, you have to pull another chair over. Or welcome. You can go ahead and get started.
Good afternoon, everyone. And I would like to thank the chairs, the co-chairs, Terry Beyer and Metzger, for asking me to be here today, or allowing me to be here today. Maybe I ought to say it that way. I am Joanne Austin, and I'm chairman of the board of ADEC, a dental equipment manufacturing company located in Newburgh. The company employs nearly 1,000 people and is the largest employer in Yamhill County. Highway 99W is used by most going to and from work. The bottleneck is very well known throughout the region and has even affected our hiring in the past, as qualified candidates are reluctant to face the commute between Newburgh and Dundee. There is also the negative impact of transportation and of goods and services from Portland all the way to the Central Oregon coast. There is a big concern for those with health problems or accident victims and the need to quickly get to the hospital. The growing wine industry, together with tourism, is definitely affected by our transportation problems. Those experiencing a 20-minute plus travel time to drive 2 miles between Newburgh and Dundee will tell others of their frustration with the traffic and may not be too excited to return to the area. Travel to and from the casino is also affected. I want to tell you how much we appreciate the inclusion of the $192 million in House Bill 2001 for the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. Thank you for recognizing the statewide significance of the project. This is a very important down payment on phase one of the bypass. There will be two more following. However, this is a very important first start. Please continue to support the transportation package as written. Also, be assured that business will support the fee increases included in the package. My sincere appreciation for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Chair Beyer and Chair Metzger and committee. My name is Cheryl Kelsch. I'm executive director of the Chehalem Valley Chamber of Commerce, and we represent over 400 member businesses in Yamhill County, and I'm simply here to thank you. So I appreciate the work that you've done on this package and echo Joanne's comments that we hope that this sails through your committee and to the floor, both the Senate and House floor. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm represented, Senator Berger. Thank you very much, Mrs. Austin. Before you leave,
yes.
I appreciate all of the testimony by everyone, but I cannot let you leave without recognizing your wonderful leadership throughout the years in family businesses, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for that.
Well, aren't you very nice? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I was actually, Ken, Mr. Austin, sitting back in the weeds. I was hoping he'd be up here so he can talk to us about his old cars. Maybe he'll have more room now to drive him around the area.
Chris Myers and Mike Salzgiver.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Myers. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Association of Engineering Employees. This is a group of employees, about 1,170 folks that work in the engineering and technical fields in the Oregon Department of Transportation, Department of Forestry, and Park and Rec Department. And the association supports the bulk of House Bill 2001. We are, however, concerned about Section 23 of this version A17. Well, we believe that a fair comparison will show our brothers and sisters in the ODOT maintenance forces to be the best value for the taxpayer, there are those among us with extensive backgrounds of consultant and contractor employment as field workers and managers who are concerned that the winners of the contracts called for in Section 23 would collaborate with other entities such that even if the contractors actually lost money, the pilot program would appear to be a success. To preclude such an event, we request that the data collected be of sufficient detail and be presented with sufficient clarity that a competent layperson should be able to understand the expenditures and be able to recognize whether or not the expenditures are reasonable when compared to expenditures for similar services provided by ODOT employees, the employees of other government agencies, and the rates charged to private enterprise. While one 10-mile segment of highway might be a starting point, we can see that, depending on the segment chosen, the results might not give a true picture of the validity of the idea. Some of our members feel that multiple pilots in a variety of conditions would give a more valid result. In conclusion, we welcome a fair, open, and honest test. We would object to the taxpayers being victimized by being lowballed to get contractors in the door, only to have unreasonable price escalation happen to allow the contractors to recover losses incurred in a lowball effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, I see nothing. Okay, go ahead.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, I am Mike Salzgiver. I serve as Executive Director for Associated General Contractors. I'm mindful of the time, but I do have a few data points that I'd like to share with you. But before I do, I want to thank, there are too many people to thank, but many of you on this panel, the governor's office, others in the representing organizations around the state have all contributed to bringing this bill this far. But there are two primary reasons why AGC supports House Bill 2001. One, it's good for the economy. We see the bigger picture. Oregon has a $30 billion or more backlog in statewide transportation projects, maintenance, modernization, transit, and we need to move forward on those. There's a critical need to keep Oregon's infrastructure advanced and modernized so that Oregon can compete economically. The second reason is to look at the human element. In normal economic times, construction is usually number two or number three, the number two or second or third largest economic sector in Oregon's economy. Today, we are losing jobs at the rate of 2,600 a month. And when you look at the rate of unemployment in our industry, we have lost, since our peak in 2007, over 26,000 jobs, and it's continuing to fall. Unemployment in Oregon is at about 11 or 12%. In our industry, we're at 22.5% and continuing up. We're even higher in construction unemployment in Oregon than the national unemployment average for construction. So when you look at the human element, there's few things that government can do that are more important than getting this bill passed. So I want to thank you for demonstrating exceptional leadership in bringing this bill this far, and we urge the committee to report it to both chambers as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. See any questions? Thank you for coming. Vern Groves and Stephanie Routh.
Thank you for this opportunity to share our views. I will be giving testimony on behalf of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and its Oregon Interfaith Power and Light Committee, of which I'm a part. We are asking you to strengthen HB 2001 a bill that started out as a balanced transportation package but is now dominated by an $840 million highway funding bill that increases Oregon's carbon footprint and air pollution and does little to improve mobility, especially for those who are dependent on public transportation outside of the Portland area. These are often people of low incomes or who, due to age and disability, do not drive. This bill shows no evidence of serving a state transportation or economic development strategy. Since the late 1990s, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, in its environmental programs, have been educating and advocating on global warming and energy use as moral issues. We have helped over 500 congregations and their members reduce their carbon footprints and save money at the same time. Principles of justice and stewardship guide our thinking and practice. Investing in alternative transportation, planning for walkable communities, and road maintenance rather than building new roads is one of the ways we can create a healthy environment and a healthy economy for Oregonians. As is, HB 2001 would put Oregon in the back seat in terms of advancing mobility and livable communities, as well as undermining the state's goals for greenhouse gas reduction. HB 2001 includes a list of nearly 50 new roads or road widening projects around the state. Oregon needs a transportation package that benefits all of its citizens by investing in public transportation, pedestrian and bike-friendly projects, and road maintenance rather than just building new roads. We urge you to strengthen HB 2001 or vote against it. As a legislator, it is your duty to protect the health, safety, and well-being of Oregonians. By moving this bill ahead with its tunnel vision, you will be putting your duty in the back seat for short-term gains for a few. The following are ways that the bill could be strengthened. One, restore a minimum of $24 million per year in federal flexible funds for non-highway transportation purposes, including transit, which will especially help lower-income citizens, the elderly and disabled who depend on public transit. Two, widen mobility options by restoring the minimum bike pedestrian project expenditure level of 1.5%, or otherwise ensure increased funding for these modes through a non-motorized vehicle transportation fund. Three, restore metropolitan area greenhouse gas emission reduction planning provisions equivalent to those provided for Portland Metro for at least the Eugene Springfield metropolitan area. And four. No, there's no four. There's three. Okay. I thought the next page might have another one. So as people of faith, we seek healthy, livable, and just communities for all people, regardless of income level. The investments our state makes in transportation options now will have a tremendous impact on the shape and livability of our communities and the health of God's creation in years to come. Many of you are tempted to do what is quick and easy, doing business as usual and putting all your transportation and mobility eggs in one basket. That basket that feeds Oregon's continued dependence on foreign oil and contributes to climate disruption will not help put us on a road to long-term prosperity, greater social equity, and good stewardship of creation. Please do what is right for Oregonians and this beautiful environment that has been entrusted to our care. Strengthen HB 2001 or vote against it. Thank you.
Stephanie?
My name is Stephanie Ralph. I'm the Executive Director for the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, and first I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity to speak today. The Willamette Pedestrian Coalition is a nonprofit organization working to improve conditions for walking in the region. We support efforts that reduce climate impacts, improve community livability, and improve the health of Oregon's citizens. While we support smart investments in our transportation infrastructure, we believe that several proposed amendments to this legislation, HB 2001, are headed down the wrong road. We applaud the state's commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We do not believe that allocating $840 million specifically to highway projects fulfills that commitment. And we believe that the increase in road project funds for pedestrian and bike facilities from 1 to 1.5% is an important step in the right direction that now appears to be deleted from this legislation. We strongly urge you to reinstate this provision. 2/3 of these funds provide vital improvements for pedestrian infrastructure, connecting people to storefronts, to schools, to the destination that define people's daily lives. The proposed Section 17 of this bill outlines criteria for selecting transportation projects for funding, yet these criteria say very little about encouraging alternative modal options such as walking, bicycling, and transit. The criteria state does not undermine sustainable urban developments. We suggest that any funded transportation project must enhance or enable sustainable development. We further suggest that the project selection criteria outlined in this section, Section 17, be applied to Section 65. We also encourage that the criterion calling for decreasing traffic crash rates be expanded to address conflicts among all modes of traffic. Our great state needs to continue a shift towards more sustainable travel options. This new language seems to have taken a detour to the past, which gives us alarm and disappointment. Please reconsider amendments that compromise and eliminate a more multimodal approach to getting around. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you. Jeff Mandel and Chris Hagerbaumer. You can go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jeff Mandel. I'm a shoemaker. I live in Portland. And I had heard about some of the changes to this bill just last night. And so in my haste to get down here, I tried to figure out how could I make it here by 5. So I thought, well, it's a meeting about transportation. What are my transportation options? I could fly or walk or take a train or take a car. Flying was a little too energy intensive, I thought, just for this meeting. Walking, it was going to take too long. The train, you know, the only train at 2:00 is the Coast Starlight, which the people of Amtrak have described as a way of life. If you've ever had to take the Coast Starlight, it usually arrives 18 hours to more later than it's expected to arrive. But that's changed with the new head of Amtrak. It now runs on time, and the guys at the station will vouch for it. So really the only option was to take a car. I came by car. So our transportation infrastructure forced me into the riskiest mode of travel that we have in the United States. It's probably the riskiest mode of travel actually in the world. It's in fact the riskiest mode of travel on the planet. In the United States alone, NHTSA tells us we have 42,000 dead on the road each year in the United States. 42,000 dead on the road each year in the United States. Most of those are young people. So I risked my neck to be here today. thanks for having me. I heard there were some great provisions in this bill that have since disappeared, which is actually why I came down. And they were really about land use planning, greenhouse gas, and about the microscopic amount of funding for non-motorized transportation. So I had to risk my neck in motorized transportation to get here, partly because only 1% was allocated previously to non-motorized transportation. But even that apparently is issue to contest. Well, okay, so land use planning. So if I came on the train, I could come to the Salem train station. you know, I probably would have had to actually plan a few more hours just to get from the Salem train station to here, because it's not really nearby. And so land use planning would be, hey, maybe we could move the train station nearby, and wouldn't that be a great thing? Greenhouse gas reductions, like instead of coming here in cars, individually, as we probably all had to, maybe there would have been some other options. We don't have like a statewide transportation service for public transportation. It's all localized, county-based. So if we had actually a statewide bus service, perhaps we could have bus service not only in the metro areas, but in the rural areas. The budget of pooled resources actually being enough to cover everybody. Wouldn't that be great? I'm not suggesting that today. I just kind of put it aside. And so the level that greenhouse gas is causing a carbon emissions, right? A problem recognized at the national level. Here in Oregon, we say we care, but apparently we want to have an image of caring, but we're not really putting the money or the planning or the policy around it. So we decided maybe that really wasn't necessary in the bill. And then there's the issue of non-motorized transportation. A 0.5% increase, which was problematic for some members. And I guess the real numbers of that are somewhere around like $12 million over 2 years for non-motorized transportation. I mean, it's not a lot of money, really. But an increase of 0.5%, you know, that would have helped at least a little in that already tiny budget. I'm going to summarize here just by saying, let's not throw good money after bad by earmarking so much, you know, $840 million, not just now, but for the next 20 years, basically, orienting a transportation policy around highway projects and downplaying the emphasis on the combined effect that we get from investing in land use planning and greenhouse gas reduction and non-motorized transportation. It's like old coal. I mean, we know that we wouldn't invest in old coal. We've heard about clean coal, and maybe we wouldn't invest in that now either. But we know for sure the old way, just burning stuff up, the dirty stuff, we're not going to do that. So when I think of highway projects, that kind of comes to mind. They sort of remind me of old coal. And we have so many new and better options these days to take advantage of. Non-motorized transportation is one of them, but even just fixing the train. Hey, and we've done a lot. I used to live in Eugene, and I was here to take advantage of the Cascades when the Cascade line opened up. It's great. You could commute to Salem from Eugene on the Cascades, but not from Portland. There's no morning trains. You know, and then there's no afternoon trains going back to Portland. Maybe you know that, too. I'm going to ask my representatives to vote against the bill in its current form, but I would ask you on the committee to consider reinstating those great proposals that have somehow disappeared in the process. Bring back land use planning and bring back the greenhouse gas emissions reduction planning. And you could go beyond 0.5% increase even in the non-motorized transportation. You get a huge investment. That same money pays for jobs. While a highway project may seem big in scale, and these other projects not so big in scale, they provide no fewer jobs. But they provide better value for the dollar and better value for Oregonians in the long run. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chris. Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hager-Baumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. As I was driving down here today, the song on the radio was, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And I was kind of thinking, wouldn't there be a better song to be hearing right now? Something like, Why Can't We All Be Friends? So I'm here today to say that I do consider you all friends. I consider our fellow transportation stakeholders friends. Our organization was really honored to participate in the process that brought us the original transportation package that was 2120. That package was really moving the state towards a cost-effective and sustainable 21st century transportation system that supports both the economy and the environment. But we do feel that this bill has taken a turn in the wrong direction. I'm sorry, everybody up here keeps using transportation, not idioms, but you know what I'm talking about. And we really want to ask you today to approve House Bill 2001 to ensure that it creates jobs by working on the smartest, highest priority transit and road projects, that it lowers transportation costs by giving Oregonians better transportation choices, and that it builds stronger, healthier communities with a lower carbon footprint and cleaner air. And I'm just going to focus on that last point. As you know, Legislative Council accidentally did not include the governor's original intent, which was to incorporate the Vision Committee's recommendation that Oregon's six major metropolitan areas set targets for reducing greenhouse gases from transportation and incorporate global warming considerations into transportation and land use planning undertaken in those regions, and then give up those and other interested communities the new tools and resources they would need to do that. Now, that piece is in the bill for the Portland metro region, and it's really close. It almost extends it to the Eugene-Springfield metro region, which is what we're looking for, but it doesn't really require that region. And with my testimony, I also handed out the letter that was signed by our organization and five others that talks about the reasons why we feel there are certain parts of this bill that have been stripped out that make it difficult for us to support it anymore. So I would just like you to think about how we need to get transportation and land use right from the outset. Think back to some of the roads in Oregon today were actually wagon trails at one point. And so when you lay down transportation infrastructure, it typically endures for a very, very long time and has a really profound impact on how communities develop. We want to make sure that the way that we develop the transportation investments that we make positively affect those communities and the environment and the residents' quality of life. So the planning requirements that were envisioned, and there's a good portion of that in the bill now, would spur better communities that lower transportation costs and help both businesses and citizens thrive. They would help people get a grip on transportation expenses because they would help create regions where trips are shorter, where commutes are shorter, where people can spend, then, if they aren't in their car all the time, can spend more time with their families and doing the kind of things they want to do. And very importantly, they would help us meet this challenge of global warming and reduce unhealthy air pollution. So we just urge you to reconsider your decision to scale those planning requirements back. And we would then hope, in addition, for a bit more funding for the bike PIDs, and this issue of the project list, some of my other colleagues and friends will talk about later.
Questions? Representative Widener and then Boone.
It might be the same one. I just wanted to help you out, sir. If you look out the window there, the train station's just on the other side. It's about three blocks from here.
And I would just, Chris, thank you for your testimony and those who've gone before you. I'd like to ask you to also remember, in terms of the entire state, some of it's rural, and there are different needs and availabilities and capacities in some of the more outside of the city areas, as far as mass transit, et cetera, and thinking of trains, for example. Mr. Mandel brought up trains. Gosh, I'd love to be able to take the train home every weekend, but it just isn't there. And the bus takes 8 hours. And so it's just, if anybody's ever interested in doing a ride along with me for a week, 25,000 miles a year on the road, and that's just without session. So there's a lot of a bigger area to consider when you're thinking of some of the things that you're asking us to change. And if everything went to bike paths and all that, and I'm all for bike paths, I think Europe's done a great job with its non-motorized travel planning in their cities. And even in some areas outside of some of those larger cities, it's a lot smaller for one thing, but we do have to think of areas that are very out there in that sense where Rep. Bentz lives, for example. And consider that when you're asking us to make these changes, because that would leave a lot of those people out.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Lisa Adato and Scott Bricker.
Committee chairs and committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Lisa Adato, and I'm from a group called Climate Solutions, and our purpose, our organization's purpose, is to find sensible, realistic, and profitable solutions to climate. We realize that in order to solve climate, we need to figure out ways to do that that are aligned with people's real lives and real companies and real economic opportunities. And I would like to cover areas that haven't been covered before, so here are a couple of my observations about today's transportation bill. And I also should note, in my previous position at the Oregon Business Association and through my current job at Climate Solutions, I've had an opportunity to be a member of a number of the work groups and planning groups that led to this bill, so I can appreciate some of the context. Some of my observations, first of all, congestion is a key problem, and safety is a key problem in Oregon. So we are very appreciative of a need to spend our dollars to improve the quick movement of goods and services through Oregon and to maintain the safety of our citizens. A second point, Chris touched on this a bit, but transportation lasts forever. So once you've laid those roads, you are creating a lifestyle and consumer choices that are going to be there for the next 50 or 60 years, or hundreds of years. So that is it. So when we're being persnickety, it's not just to be nasty about it, but to remind ourselves that these are very significant, very significant decisions. Another point, federal and state laws will soon be passed, or regional laws that reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. That's going to be coming. And our utilities and our consumers, our transportation providers, and our citizens will need to adapt to that reality. Permits will limit the amount of fossil fuels. So it's important that we design our cities and we design our transportation infrastructure just to be aligned with that reality. So the more effective and efficient our transportation infrastructure can be, the more we'll save costs for our companies and consumers. Customers are also starting to ask about the carbon footprint of their consumer goods. So if we are selling a Christmas tree here in Oregon and we need to transport it to customers in New York, for example, they are sometimes saying, what's the carbon footprint of that transportation? So our producers here in Oregon need to be cognizant about the carbon cost of the goods that they produce. Companies like Walmart and other companies are looking at what they call their own carbon footprint. So the more that we can streamline our transportation choices, the more we can provide an advantage for the companies that produce things here in Oregon and transport them to other places. Trains and barges offer transportation solutions that are significant, that have less carbon, that are less carbon intensive. We should be aware of that with our transportation thinking. And in urban areas, pedestrian and bike transportation isn't just a nice, you used to think about it as something that your children did as they rode to the playground, but now it's a serious transportation option for many of our commuters. But it's not always safe. I know that I'm often limited in not wanting to ride a bike. I'm just it's frightening, and this is it's definitely an urban issue, not so much a rural issue. I'd like to point out there's lots of really good things about this transportation bill, and we really appreciate all the environmental thinking that's gone into it. The state has added new environmental thinking on a statewide basis as you're looking at your planning. And we also really appreciate the transfer of some of the flex fuels to modes other than to multimodal transportation. So there's a lot of really good stuff in this. But I do want you to think too particularly about the planning at the MPO level. And it's little things that make a huge difference that that people might not think about. I know I'm personally just moving from the city, the inner city in Portland, to a suburb, and I'm delighted to do that. But nevertheless, I'm aware that the transportation is very different, and it makes it much harder to walk places. If you've looked at developments that have sort of a curlicue versus a grid, those little changes actually make a huge difference and make it much less safe to walk or ride bikes, much less easy to use other modes other than cars. So with that, for that reason, we would like to see the MPO planning, because that's the local planning, move as quickly as possible to the other MPO regions. We think that will benefit citizens, and we think that will benefit our environment and allow us to reduce our use of expensive transportation options. And I think I'll stop there. We'd like to see you add additional planning in, either now or in the future. And just, again, we're being persnickety, because although we want the jobs, and we badly want the jobs, we want the investment, we want the safety, we think it's worth your time to spend a little bit more, put a little bit more in for planning. We don't think that will take any of the benefits away, but it will allow local communities to use our latest thinking about how to improve our transportation options. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I've been refraining from responding to a few comments, but I do want to respond a little bit on the planning piece and the MPOs and the fact that I think our problem this session has been that we're trying to take a model that fits one area and just lay it over other MPOs, and their structures are different, and it's pretty impossible to do that. And instead of spending so much time fighting about doing it, I think we should have been looking at a way to do it that fit those models. And I certainly would have been much happier if we could have spent our time doing that. Yeah. I also want to say that if people out here or people up here are interested, check in with your local governments and see what they're doing, mm-hmm. because they are doing a lot mm-hmm. in those jurisdictions to address these issues. I think we're discounting a lot of the work that's being done. And so I think that what I would like to do mm-hmm. is to look at this as we move forward so that we can actually find a model that fits for these other jurisdictions.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. I think that's a great idea.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the Joint Committee. My name is Scott Bricker. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. And the BTA was also part of the pre-session committee that got together and was part of the groups that supported the proposal coming to the legislature. And they're also one of the groups that's on that joint letter that was submitted to you a little bit earlier that has strong concerns about where this program has ended up. I actually want to go off of on what Chair Beyer has stated, that the state of Oregon has done a lot, and so have metro regions around the state and communities around the state to support smart transportation and land use investments. For example, and things that are good for the economy and good for jobs, there was a study done by Mr. Courtwright that found that $800 million is saved in the Portland metro area alone and stays in the local economy just because people drive less. That 79.8 million dollars would also be saved if people drove even less. Around our state, we have high quality main streets, we have high quality towns and communities, and there's a long history of smart planning, of smart transportation investment, and our concerns, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance's concerns about this program is that there seems to be very little movement in those directions and things that the state has a long history in providing. Bicycle and pedestrian transportation, the construction of those projects are excellent for the economy. A recent study that I saw said that 19.19 jobs per million are created for every project that's built, and that's higher than estimates for freeway projects. As I mentioned earlier, for every mile saved, there's money that stays in the local economy. And if bicycling and walking doubled in the Portland metro region, there would be 123 citizens would save $123 million in gas and $80 million in their health care bills. Another study I saw said that for every mile bicycled, a dollar is saved in the health care system. Congressman Wu and Blumenauer have requested at the federal level a high priority project for 100 miles of bicycle boulevards in the city of Portland. That project would cost $25 million and create 600 high paying quality jobs. That's the same cost as 1 mile of average freeway. That project would effectively help double bicycling in the city. Now, I recognize that every community is different around the state. However, getting to Representative Boone's comments, when I was at Pendleton for the roundup after the Cycle Oregon bicycle ride that was in Eastern Oregon this summer, this last September, I spent a couple nights in Pendleton, walked around the streets there in the main streets, and projects like this, investments that could come out of this transportation package could improve downtown Pendleton so that it was even more attractive place, so that more people could fit on the sidewalks, so that businesses could actually operate more effectively and capitalize better. The same thing along the coast. There are communities along up and down the coast that thrive on tourism population, people being required to bicycle and walk, mostly walk, quite frankly. And actually, one myth I want to dispel is that the 1% for bikes, over 65% of those dollars is spent on sidewalks. So it's really mostly goes towards pedestrian construction. Communities like Sisters, communities like Astoria that has the Great River Walk that's highlighted by hotels as you look on the websites of the hotels. Communities like Ashland that have reclaimed Siskiyou Boulevard so that the community could build sidewalks and bicycle facilities, all in the name of economic development. These are smart projects that should be funded by the state. And to me, it's surprising that we have our congressional delegation asking for money, but nothing could be identified here. No additional resources have been identified in this bill. I do want to thank for bicycling and walking. No new resources. I do want to thank the committees for the work on creating a non-motorized transportation to urban trails program. And I think that the language that's in the bill is very solid. We were hoping that there would be some financial resources to put into that project, and perhaps the set-aside of the federal transportation dollars is one of the places that this committee was looking at for that. So we hope that there would be more dollars and resources going towards non-motorized transportation, which is a vital aspect of Oregon's history and of our economy today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Boone,
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Scott, yeah, just to clarify it, you're absolutely right. And City of Cannon Beach has even put in on one side of all the streets ramps, you know, for people in motorized wheelchairs. And they don't like people to ride on the sidewalk because there's just too many walkers. But
yes.
I was talking more about between and getting from point A to point B. There's very little in choice. There's a little bit of mass transit there. If you call the bus, it's called the bus. It's a bus, and it goes from Astoria down to Seaside and Cannon Beach. But that's the only place it doesn't go into Portland. That's the Amtrak bus, and it kind of comes and goes. But it takes a long time, and really we are relegated to driving. And then we have the during the winter. There's those issues like ice and snow. But you're absolutely right, and we have been doing those things locally, too. As the chair mentioned, there's been a lot of local transportation planning, as much as they don't have a lot of money, but they do these projects. So it is happening locally, too, so don't worry about the for you, Lisa, yeah. MP something, or no, MPO, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, I just want to note that it's our intention to allocate $1 million to the Urban Trails Fund, and that will be done during the Ways and Means process.
Chair Byer, Chair Metzger, thank you for that, Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate it. John Charles and Melissa Unger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. Since I've only been reviewing these amendments for the last 40 minutes, my comments will not be entirely polished. So I'll call your attention to a few things that might be of concern. In Section 3, the congestion pricing pilot project, which is something I've been interested in for 20 years, and I support that as a direction to move towards as road user fees and variable pricing, and I'm glad you're doing it. The exemption in sub 3, line 7, to motor vehicles with a weight of 26,000 pounds, I guess I understand there's maybe a political reason for that. There certainly is not an analytical reason for that. I understand that heavy vehicles pay a weight mile tax appropriately, but congestion is not about the wear on the pavement. It's about how much space we all take up on the highway. Now, at any given point in a congested highway, most vehicles are passenger vehicles, and they are imposing congestion costs on everyone else. But when that congestion gets freed up through congestion pricing, heavy trucks with highly valued cargo and highly paid drivers are going to benefit very considerably from free flow conditions. So if you're ordering ODOT to design and implement a congestion pricing project, what you're going to exempt from the fee a significant category of the vehicles, you're potentially setting up the project to fail. You're certainly setting up the process of a lot of motorists paying the fee to be very upset and express that anger in a way that also makes it fail. So I think that needs to be reconsidered a bit. Section 38 and 39, the whole planning exercise. Just say that if any of you have had the misfortune of ever being exposed to LCDC's Goal 12 transportation planning rule, one of the most hated rules in the state, even by many urban planners, Section 38 and 39 is sort of the TPR on steroids, as I read it. People like that kind of stuff, great. I predict it's not going to work. It's going to be a big waste of money. And if you want to do it, fine, but it's not going to accomplish anything. Section 41, speaking in code phrase there, this unnamed bridge in Urban County, authorizing establishing a registration fee on line 21 of page 23 for the bridge, and then not allowing the bridge to be used by vehicles weighing more than 26,000 pounds. I'm not understanding that. Of course, I wasn't part of the work group, so I understand there's code words in here that I don't get. But I think Multnomah County is already going to get tolling authority, at least one bill that authorizes Multnomah County to toll bridges passed out of another committee unanimously just a couple days ago. I believe the appropriate thing for all these bridges, Selwood and others, is to be tolled, for everyone to pay the toll, and for all vehicles of all weights to use the bridge and pay appropriately. That would solve Multnomah County's problem. Sections 43 to 50, the whole price increase across the board to everything. My experience, having participated in hundreds of these exercises over the last 20 years, is that becomes the fatal flaw, is an attempt to raise a fee on everything all at the same time. And then the hope for political alliance fails, voters get upset, collapses. My suggestion, trying to be helpful here, is don't raise fees on vehicle ownership. Focus the fee increase on the actual use of the fee, like a gas tax or congestion pricing fee, because owning the vehicle doesn't impose much of a cost on society, almost none. It's the use of the fee where the cost is imposed and where you can argue more credibly with people that raising a variable fee is more fair. I think if you try to raise all fees simultaneously across the board, that's where you run into political problems. Section 65, naming all the projects, I like that idea. I think that's probably the only way you could get this passed, is to specifically say where you're going to spend it. And I don't have a big alliance with any particular project, but a lot of the ones you have there I think are good ideas, and it's fine with me. There is one source of revenue that you, I'm surprised, as you're looking as thoroughly as you have for revenue, you missed one, which is that in at least one unnamed city larger than 500,000 in population, there's a huge amount of parking fee revenue that gets routinely siphoned off away from motorists and used for other purposes. For instance, one such city, Portland, is squandering more than $22 million per year from parking revenues goes to non-road purposes. And between 2003 and 2008, parking revenue from street fees, street parking, and a slice of the city-owned garages increased by 41%. But virtually none of that went to benefit the motorists who actually paid it. It all got siphoned off to non-road projects. Well, that's over $90 million in that period. It could have done a lot to maybe prevent a disaster on the Sullivan Bridge that wasn't spent that way. And to make matters worse, that's money going to PDOT. PDOT itself doesn't actually get all the revenue from city-owned garages. A big chunk of that goes completely to non-transportation purposes. So my suggestion is, as long as you're in the mood to preempt local gas taxes, maybe you should also preempt local jurisdictions from taking parking revenue and spending it for non-road purposes, and that if they own garages and they have parking meters, that revenue should be restricted to the kind of uses under the Constitution, Section 3A, that gas tax revenue is restricted, and then those local jurisdictions that are complaining so much about the money they don't have would have more money for roads. My final comment is with regard to safety. I do believe we have a safety problem in the state. On a per-mile travel basis, the safest possible way to travel after airline is to travel on a rural interstate highway. It's safer than any other mode and getting safer all the time. And as you authorize money for these projects, I do hope you'll kind of look at why is it that traveling on a rural interstate is so much safer and try and make our rural highways in Oregon that are not interstates be designed and engineered and performed more like rural interstates, and will save a lot of carnage on the roads. Thank you.
Senator Starr.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just wanted to address one particular issue that Mr. Charles brought up, and I appreciate your testimony, and I probably agree with you more than maybe any other member that's sitting up here. But the one issue I wanted to specifically address is the issue you brought up about that one bridge and that crosses the Willamette River. It is the Sellwood Bridge. The reason, quite frankly, that we're limited that bridge to, once it gets reconstructed, to vehicles that are 26,000 pounds or less, has to do, quite honestly, with the requirement of cost responsibility between heavy vehicles and light vehicles. And it's an issue of cost responsibility. Currently, the bridge is weight restricted. Currently, trucks don't use it. And so this really wasn't a significant give. It's not a place that heavy trucks generally drive. And in order to maintain the balance as it relates to cost responsibility, that's really the bottom line reason that that particular language was put into this particular bill. You know, putting together a bill like this is a lot like, you know, the old saying, I'm making a sausage, and sometimes you don't want to see it in the process, but there's a myriad of compromises that have gone into this particular bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Melissa.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm representing SEIU Local 503, who represents over 44,000 workers in the state of Oregon. And I'm actually here specifically regarding our ODOT maintenance workers. And I want to focus on a very small piece of this broader package. We generally think that more money for maintenance will likely provide higher quality and safer roads, but we are concerned with Section 23 of House Bill 2001 regarding a pilot project to contract out maintenance on a particular piece of a highway to be chosen by ODOT. And while we understand that it's just a pilot project, we don't believe it's necessary, and we think it possibly moves us in the wrong direction. I provided a report from the Washington Department of Transportation that details how contracting of maintenance has worked and mainly not worked in other states. And why other states, with the other states' experience, I don't see why Oregon wants to possibly move in this direction. I would argue that Oregon's maintenance on our highways is even more complicated than many of these other states. With snow removal, landslides, and floods, our maintenance crews often have to go above and beyond to keep Oregonians moving. For instance, one of our members, who I know pretty well, Cameron McGinnis, who lives in Cove, Oregon, spent 2 weeks removing a landslide where he worked every day of those 2 weeks for 15 to 18 hours a day until the job was done. And he put his life on hold to the extent of when I tried to get a hold of him, his wife would pick up his cell phone to make sure that that job got done so Oregonians could keep moving because that highway otherwise was closed. And to him, it was not just a job. He was dedicated to his job serving Oregonians and to make sure that they could move throughout the state, which I believe is different than when we contract out the maintenance of our roads. While there's, I don't believe, and our organization doesn't believe, there's any substantial proof that contracting actually saves money or provides better quality work, we are concerned that we'd be looking at expanding what we currently contract at ODOT. We even have recent examples with Highway 20, Pioneer, Eddyville, problems, or the Ross brothers who were banned from public contracting because of problems that make it seem that in some ways our contracting hasn't solved many. The system is actually flawed. You know, one idea to throw out there to improve the idea of a pilot project is actually to make sure in that process that it would cost less. Make sure that actually before you contract that you do analysis of the cost that it costs the state and what it would cost otherwise to do the work in-house and only proceed if it actually would cost less. Our maintenance workers work every day to keep our roads safe and keep Oregonians moving, and we believe that that's an important part of the work that they provide here in Oregon. So we are concerned with Section 23 in this bill.
Thank you. There are no comments. Thank you. Marion Hayes and Mel Rader.
Good evening, Chair Beyer and Metzger committee members. My name is Marion Hayes. I'm the Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. OBA strongly supports passage of House Bill 2001. We believe this package addresses the variety of transportation needs around the state, the need to move goods reliably and efficiently, the need to provide transportation options for people and freight, and the need to address the impact of transportation on climate. We think this package strikes the right balance. I would testified before both transportation committees in the 2007 session about a study that was done, the cost of congestion and highway limitations, and I'd just like to review a couple of findings from that. Approximately one in five Oregon jobs are transportation-related or transportation-reliant. Businesses around the state are already feeling the impacts of inadequate transportation systems and growing congestion. We also learned that failing to adequately invest in the transportation system may cost Oregon's economy $1.7 billion and 16,000 permanent jobs by 2025, as well as significant numbers of construction jobs. This should be unacceptable. I'd also like to note that OBA put together a climate-friendly transportation subcommittee as we were looking at developing our agenda for this session, and virtually all the recommendations from our subcommittee are incorporated in some form in House Bill 2001. There is funding for non-highway modes, a congestion pricing pilot project, development of a least cost planning model, and beginning down that road of integrating our transportation, land use, and greenhouse gas reduction goals. Taking action now can not only
will not only help ensure the state doesn't suffer long-term economic losses, it can provide a short-term boost by creating jobs at a time when we need them so desperately. We recognize that this is a difficult time to generate additional revenue, but we view this as an investment from which we will reap rewards in the form of job creation, long-term economic benefit, and quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Mel Rader. I'm the project director for Upstream Public Health. My organization is dedicated to promoting policies at the community level and statewide level that promote health. And our transportation system has significant impacts on the public's health. And unfortunately, many of these impacts are not considered in the policymaking process at the statewide level or local level. My organization commissioned with Oregon Health and Science University to produce a report on the health impact assessment of policies to reduce vehicle miles traveled in Oregon. This is actually the first ever health impact assessment using CDC, Centers for Disease Control methodology on policies to reduce vehicle miles traveled. Some of the health impacts of our transportation system, you know, we've talked about car collisions, which average around nearly 500 deaths a year in Oregon and nearly 30,000 injuries per year. And other areas include air pollution, which many estimates show that air pollution causes more deaths per year than car collisions. In addition, changes in physical activity from our transportation system can be fairly significant. Those that use public transit on average spend 16 minutes walking during their commute. Those that drive on average spend 1.5 minutes walking. Considering that the recommended physical activity levels are for 30 minutes per day, those that take public transit meet half of their physical activity levels on average. Unless you think Oregon is doing better than the rest of the countries, in some ways they are, in some ways they aren't. And I would mention that Oregon actually has the second highest rate of asthma in the country. Last year it had the highest rate of any state in the country. Now 355,000 people in the state with asthma, and a lot of that is related to vehicle use. I want to specifically speak to the policy around vehicle miles traveled in order to link to greenhouse gas emission standards. This is a policy not only to address global warming, but it is also a fairly profound policy to promote physical activity and reduce air pollution-related morbidity and mortality. So I encourage you to consider ways to encourage more alternative modes of transportation, and in particular extending the targets for VMT to Eugene and other metropolitan planning organizations. I also urge you to look at using flexible funds for non-highway uses as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Paul.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I'm surprised you didn't talk about the cookies at the rest stop. Do you guys have an issue with that by chance? I'm just kidding, you don't have to answer that.
I promote alternative. We're not done yet, Representative. I'm sure someone is focusing on that one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Stacey and Brock Howe.
I thought that question was aimed at me, Madam Chair.
I know better.
Chair Metzger, Chair Beyer, members of both committees, I'm Bob Stacey, Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm pleased to be back with the House committee members to continue the dialogue about this important legislation and to provide testimony to the Senate members as well. Chris Hagerbaumer earlier this evening distributed a letter that contains our primary points as well on behalf of 1000 Friends of Oregon and possibly on behalf of Mr. Howell as well. I won't try to belabor everything in that letter, but I'll borrow one note from Chris. You know, we've been working on this package and trying to make a transportation package come about along with a lot of other stakeholders for a very long time, going back to
to earlier than this last year when we and others were invited to participate in the Vision Committee to put together a proposal for your consideration. And so, of course, Chris would think about road songs and listen to the radio on the way down. I had a different Stones song in mind after I heard her suggest Can't Get No Satisfaction. It's probably You Can't Always Get What You Want. And I know that's as true of the members of the committee as it is for each of us who've been before you. I wish I could say we got what we need, but I'm not sure we have. And so I hope you'll attend to the points that we raised in that letter. I want to speak to one of them. But I want to emphasize one other thing. Rocco, I'm not stepping on your lines here. We've been supporting balanced transportation investment. Roads are very important for the reasons that Representative Boone mentioned about connecting our communities, for many other reasons, including the daily commute of millions of Oregonians who use their cars. We're not going to change that by, if we were, to increase the 1% for bikes to 1.5%. We're not going to change that with the $24 million allocation for alternative mode expenditures with federal flexible funds, even if we'd gotten all $44 million that we asked for. We were hoping for initial steps because we think a balanced transportation system is important for the economic vitality of the state of Oregon. As the world around us changes, as Oregon changes, we need to be providing choices for our communities. We remember, and I'm sure you're aware as well, that when we build transit systems, when we build bike facilities and pedestrian facilities as part of complete streets, when we rebuild our existing infrastructure, national and local analysis shows that we put at least as many, and in some cases more, people to work on those projects per $1 million of expenditure as we do when we build new roads and highways. This isn't about frustrating the immediate job creation objective of the transportation investment. And it's also true that providing transportation choices, as I think Scott Bricker pointed out, for the residents of our communities gives them all the opportunity to be a little more resilient, to have more choices in how to get around at a time when automobile-based transportation costs are going to increase, especially if we adopt a significant increase in road user fees, as is proposed in this package. Finally, balanced transportation investment, along with smart growth planning, really gives our communities a chance to reduce their carbon footprint. And Chris spoke to that, Scott has spoken to that, other witnesses have as well. Just in the spirit of continuing the dialogue that the Chair Beyer has assisted with on this issue and that other members have participated in as well, I simply want to mention that we're not proposing a one-size-fits-all strategy. We do observe that if we only do this kind of planning in the Portland metro area, we're not going to achieve the kind of greenhouse gas reductions in the transportation sector that are important statewide. The bill doesn't quite get us there on Eugene Springfield. It doesn't require local implementation. But this is not a Portland-only, it's not an Oregon-only strategy. This very strategy of greenhouse gas planning reductions through transportation and land use is embedded in many of the bills being proposed in Congress to deal with climate change and is embedded in proposals for the reauthorization of the Transportation Act. The California Legislative Assembly last year adopted it and applied it to all metropolitan planning organizations in California. And today, Governor Gregoire in Washington State required the four largest metropolitan planning organizations in Washington to undertake this kind of planning. We're not alone. We're not doing anything weird, even though it is Portland first in this bill. So we're making halting steps in the directions we've asked for. We're not satisfied with those steps. We hope you'll look again at our request for improving them. I want to speak to one additional point, and that's some concern about the project list over which you've all worked very hard. In putting this bill together, you've taken very courageous steps. You're proposing the most significant increase in gas taxes and other road user fees in 16 years. And you're doing it at a time when it could fly in the face of the economic downturn that is putting stress on Oregon households and that is making them understandably reluctant to look at higher taxes with very much favor. That's why it's all the more important to ensure that that nearly $1 billion investment that you're calling out and lining in the bill clearly is the smartest set of expenditures and investments the state of Oregon can make, because it represents something like a 20-year bonding commitment. You're using the resources available to the state, or a very large percentage of the modernization resources of the state, and you're locking them up for 20 years, and you're telling a whole bunch of other folks around the state, there's not going to be money in the kitty for a good long time unless we raise those taxes again. And that's going to be a daunting prospect for any legislature. So how can we demonstrate that this is the right billion out of the $10 billion in projects that the Oregon Transportation Commission handed you in a long list? You know, that's why you have an Oregon Transportation Commission. To go to their area committees on transportation, to ask them to come forward with their priorities, to go to the MPOs and say, what are the top projects for economic development in your communities? To go to the major stakeholder groups and say, where are the key bottlenecks for moving freight, and how can we advance that set with a good economic analysis behind it that demonstrates that's the package that Oregonians ought to support? The Transportation Commission was given an opportunity, about 24 hours long, to look at your list. They spent 45 minutes receiving testimony about it yesterday. They have not conducted the kind of analysis that would indicate or support a conclusion that this is the best that Oregon can do for the next 20 years. So our modest proposal, contained in our letter, is that you take this list, put it in the bill, direct the Transportation Commission to study it and other projects on that $10 billion list, and give you back the best possible, the strongest possible billion-dollar package for your February session, that you take that package and adopt it as the final step for this legislation. Don't fly into this storm blind. Don't pick the projects that you thought on first glance might be the most saleable. Take the ones you can be confident will spur Oregon's economy, not only with the jobs of building them, but the jobs that will be supported by that investment to the heights it needs to go from this deep depression. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Byron, Chair Metzger, and members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell. I'm the Transportation Advocate for Environment Oregon. I am certain I cannot hone the 35 years of experience that has resulted in Bob's eloquence of where my position is similarly laid. And I think that's really the perspective I have here today. I am a new Oregonian, so I am a little bit new to learning about what Oregon has done for the past 35 years. I have studied it, I've learned it for quite some time over my years in transportation, land use, planning, and law. And I've been very proud of the heritage that the Oregonians that are in my history resulted in that process coming forward. And so I'm proud Oregon has been able to have the best land use planning, the best transportation planning for the past 35 years. And we're at a juncture now to figure out what are we going to be doing for the next 20, next 35 years. And I'm deeply concerned that the investment we're making now ties us, locks us into funding for highways without considering the potential impacts on our economy, on our jobs, on the potential savings to Oregonians, to their families, to businesses, and then the potential impact on global warming as well, which is really the driving factor, obviously, for Environment Oregon of where our concern is on transportation. So I'll start with that point of facts that I'd like to leave you with. Just this week, the MIT came out with the latest and the best study that we have on the impact that global warming is going to have. There's a 90% likelihood by 2100 that the global climate will increase 9 degrees. That kind of increase we cannot handle. If we are going to have any impact on reducing that, and reducing the risks associated with that, we have to be taking action. Oregon's transportation sector contributes more than a third of our global warming pollution. This is a critical juncture to make those investments for the next century. So we need to be making the right choices today. And I'm worried that $840 million is going potentially in the wrong direction without having the appropriate OTC study of this, and without the significant investment of a balanced approach that we have come to the legislature hoping to get to start with. The second thing is we are in an economic crunch right now. There's no denying it. We're at 12.9% unemployment, and we want to create jobs. Obviously, $840 million going into highway construction and to other transportation projects is going to help create jobs. There's no denying it. But the best studies show that our biggest bang for the buck comes from public transit, from bikeways, and from sidewalks. With public transit, we get at least 30% more jobs. By not having a more balanced approach towards public for more public transit, what we're basically saying is we're willing to not have the maximum amount of jobs, and that concerns me. And I realize that these projects are over long term. They aren't necessarily this next year when we need to be getting out of this problem, but it's the potential for the long-term economy that concerns me. And the third point is with these savings, which is we know that if we get people out of their cars and into public transit or into bikes or being able to be in walkable communities, they're going to have significant savings. And again, this is a long-term solution to our economy. This is not we're going to save people money tomorrow by implementing this law. But we know if we are able to reduce those costs to families and businesses over the long term, this is going to be a good thing for Oregon. And this is why we need to be planning our communities to be reducing global warming pollution, being able to make those land use determinations of growing a little bit more densely, a little bit more around public transit and around biking and walking, so that way we can have those savings. And so I hope that we are still have the opportunity to consider these changes within this bill, as well as if we don't change now, that we have a firm commitment from the members of this committee and other legislators to work towards getting metropolitan planning to reduce global warming in the future. I think that is a critical component to making sure we go in the right direction. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thanks. Brock, my understanding that Oregon's about less than 1% of the global warming issuance in the world, and that we did do that. What was your last point? It's getting late. I'm on hour 14.
My last point was that Oregonians need to save money.
So. Well, there was the very last thing you said. Anyway, I'm pretty sure it is in this bill, what you just said. And, the planning, sorry. That Metro does do the planning in the Portland metropolitan area, which is the area that you focused on for that, the pollution, or the greenhouse gas.
Chair Byer, Representative Boone, I my choice of words may have not been clear as to exactly what I said. I said metropolitan planning, which is all metropolitan areas within the state of Oregon. So that would be Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Salem, Bend. My focus, I mean, obviously what we would like to see here is to have a requirement for Eugene Springfield to come under this requirement, and that's basically what we're asking for as a coalition and as Environment Oregon. to make sure that we expand it beyond Portland. Portland is likely to do this already, although their timeline might be different and the requirements may be different. So,
I'm sure that I heard the chair say that Springfield, at least she speaks for Springfield, is doing some local planning. So, I mean, and that we talked about the fact that a lot of these areas around the state are already doing their own local planning for and considering those kinds of things. You know, even in my humble area of the corner of the state that is fairly rural, I don't have any big cities, but every single one of them, actually Cannon Beach, we're about 1,000 people now, not during summer, but has actually won awards from international, in addition to national, for their greenhouse gas lowering capabilities. I'm losing my words here. And we actually celebrate Earth Day every year, and I speak at some point in the celebration. And there's always something, it's been about 4 years now we've been doing this, there's always something about greenhouse gas reductions things that the cities are doing. So those little tiny cities out there are really working hard.
Thank you. Representative Call and then Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really want to try to focus this so that we're saying what I think is being said here, because Representative Boone raises an important point about Oregon's role in worldwide global climate change and the phenomenon of worldwide global climate change. And pardon me, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask a leading question, but as somebody who's advocated around this policy for a while now, I've noticed a lot of folks at different times always say, well, we only contribute this much, so we have to bring these people in, and constantly looking to other countries, other states, other regions, for them to do something first. And what I think it is you're saying is that we have a responsibility, whether or not our share is as significant as another state or another country. We have a share here in Oregon, that there's a shared responsibility with regards to global climate change, that since 30% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from our transportation system, that if we're going to take on seriously our shared responsibility of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the most effective way to do that on our front is to do it through our transportation system and our transportation planning. Is that what you're saying? Either one of you can answer that.
Yes, sir.
Yes, that is exactly.
Sorry,
Chair Byer.
Thank you.
Call. That is what I'm saying. I may have to amend it slightly in that of the most effective approach. Obviously, transportation has to be dealt with, and as far as dollars that go into it, it is one of the best ways to reduce global warming pollution.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond because we've had a lot of people come up that have been talking about making this a green package. And to me, this is probably the greenest package that's ever came out of the State House, right here, what we're doing, because we've had testimony over and over. We've had ODOT come in, and by putting in weigh-in-motion scales for trucks, reduces emissions by 60%. This here is getting rid of some severe bottlenecks where trucks are sitting, cars are sitting on the throttle, off the throttle, and that puts a lot of pollution into the air. So this is probably the greenest package that's ever came out of here, because it's going to reduce those bottlenecks and get rid of some of those bottlenecks where we're not polluting as much as we are right now. And then we can get back to focusing on the different modes that you would like to focus on. But we definitely, I think, are in the right direction with what we're doing here in the package.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Angus Duncan, we're getting there, guys. And Art Schlack. Go ahead. Thank you.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Angus Duncan.
I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation in Portland, an OEA member. I chair Oregon's Global Warming Commission. I am a former energy policy director for the U.S. Department of Transportation, and I was privileged to participate in the Transportation Vision Committee the governor put together last year. After it had produced its report and it was formulated into a proposal from the governor, the Global Warming Commission took it up, took testimony, talked to the Transportation Commission, and talked to a number of city and state and other community representatives, ended up voting unanimously to support the bill as it was introduced into the legislature. Yeah, we did so because the bill included important tools for the state's managing its carbon reduction obligations. Transportation is, as others have observed, is about a third of Oregon's emissions. And just so we're thinking about that clearly, emissions don't occur state by state or even country by country. They really occur automobile by automobile and building by building, and that's the way they have to be managed. That's really the appropriate unit of management. And for the cars and the trucks and the houses and the commercial buildings we have, those are our responsibilities. That's really the way we have to functionally think about managing carbon. The commission supported this also because Oregon exports about $10 billion a year to purchase fossil fuels from out of state. Some of that's transportation fuel, some of that is utility fuel, but it's $10 billion, and I imagine all of us think we could use $10 billion kept in the state and circulating in the state supporting our economy right now. But that money doesn't, we don't have that now. It's gone. We supported it because carbon efficiency in transportation is a three-legged stool, and two of those legs we only have limited leverage over. You know, what vehicle technologies we'll see, what fuels and fuel technologies we'll see. The third one is infrastructure investment and land use planning, and that's where really the federal government depends on the states and the local governments. That is not something that either can or should be done at a national level. Some of it will certainly be mandated at a national level, as other witnesses have observed. Of the several provisions in this bill that will contribute to our meeting our carbon goals, and there are a number of them, as Chair Peterson observed, the commission regarded as particularly important the provisions that directed ODOT to develop a least cost planning process and to support the development of parallel processes and tools at local government levels, and the direction that Oregon's six MPOs engage in parallel planning to reduce local sources of greenhouse gases. You know, you've heard a lot about this today, so I'm not going to belabor the point, but obviously we are concerned that 4.5 of those six MPOs have dropped out of the bill. To meet our greenhouse goals as a state and the expected federal goals that are coming in our direction, urban areas in particular are going to have to contribute disproportionately to the realization of those goals through efficiency savings. That's where the efficiency savings are, in buildings and in transportation. Rural areas are going to have to contribute disproportionately in the development of renewable energy projects and dealing with the transmission corridors that are going to have to be developed to move those. So there are responsibilities everywhere, but the responsibilities particularly for development of efficiency in transportation and buildings are going to be found in our urban areas. And I certainly concur that a number of our cities, you know, far beyond just the six MPOs, are already engaged in the kind of planning that at least needs to get started. We, on the Transportation Vision Committee, and certainly we on the Commission, did not expect that all six MPOs would be required to develop the same warehouse full of computer equipment and very sophisticated programs that Metro has. You know, that would be unreasonable to expect, and we would not expect them to do the level of planning that Metro can do. Nor would we expect them to do planning if they didn't have the tools available from ODOT and others that allowed them to deliver on this obligation. So I am heartened, I think, by Chair Byer's suggestion that maybe there's a way to recraft this language so that the MPOs that are smaller than 500,000 in this state could conceivably be given a level of responsibility commensurate with the tools and capabilities and funding that they have right now, but that we not stop this process, that instead we get it moving at least at that level within those MPOs. And if there's a way we can help craft that language, obviously we'd be happy to do so. We've already been working as a commission with the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Oregon Transportation Commission to start developing some of those tools that allow you to look at land use, transportation, and greenhouse gases and mix them together and come out with the package that you have to have. These are process changes. You know, in many ways, process gets no respect, especially when there are millions of dollars being spent on a project list. But truly, these kinds of process changes will outlive all of those projects in terms of the economic and environmental benefits that will accrue to people in Oregon. If we start to do the kind of planning and the kind of follow-through in transportation that we've been doing for 30 years now with a huge economic and environmental benefits in planning on the utility side. So I hope there's a possibility of revisiting this issue in particular. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark.
Good evening. Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger. My name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I want to start by briefly just thanking the governor and all the people that worked on the for 9 months, I believe, working together to try and put together a recommendation that came forward with the governor. I had the pleasure of serving, I think, on all three of those technical groups that met for months at this point and got to know those people a lot better than I have for a long time. I also want to thank members of the House and Senate that have spent countless hours the last 4 months working on this transportation package. This is heavy lifting, and this is a big job. Hasn't been undertaken. Well, it's been tried to be undertaken for a number of times in the past couple of bienniums, but this hopefully we will see the fruit of your efforts. The Association of Oregon Counties finds that House Bill 2001, A Transportation Odyssey, is a broad-based bill. It addresses transportation policy as well as providing additional funding for Oregon's integrated system of state highways, county roads, and city streets. It also provides funding for multimodal projects around the state, and we find that that's extremely important and viable. There are a couple of things that, well, let me start out with also saying that while there are elements of this package that are probably would not be ones that we would probably put in if we were king for a day, there are also things that we would like to put in this package or like to see in this package if we were king for a day at this point. That in reality always doesn't happen, and we find that the package that you have crafted is one that provides for compromise, provides for consensus building, and it also provides a significant step forward in leading the state of Oregon to the ability to preserve, maintain, and modernize the road system while making advances towards a balanced transportation system. We also would comment with regard to land use and transportation in that there are a number of elements that strengthen the relationship between land use and transportation. And I say that as being a planner in the state of Oregon for a long time at this point, and I think some of you know how long that's been. But there are things that we are doing and have been doing for a number of years. And it's just not the greenhouse gas MPO planning that will lead us towards in our efforts to try and reduce carbon effects of our transportation system. We have transportation system plans that have been done, could be done better, and as a result of the direction, I think will lead us on a statewide basis to address a number of the issues.
The least cost planning also can be done as part of the transportation system plans, which all counties and cities do. And of course, the federal reauthorization of transportation funds for the United States will provide additional direction for us. So we will revisit in the next session, or even maybe in 2010, some of the elements here that we've had some discussion about here this evening. So based on all of that, Chair Metzger and Chair Beyer, the Association of Oregon Counties supports this package. We find that this package benefits the entire state, which is essential for us. And it also, the one key element that I can't help but mention is that it provides 50-30-20 distribution of the funds from the state highway program that will benefit not only the state, but the 36 counties that are a very large part of the transportation system, and also the cities of the state of Oregon at this point. So with that, we certainly appreciate your efforts and urge you to move this package forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. And last but not least, we have Craig Honeyman and Brenda Wilson.
Craig really is.
I'm co-chair, members of the Special Transportation Committee. My name is Craig Honeyman. With the League of Oregon Cities, and I very much appreciate your taking my testimony at this late hour. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, we're on the threshold of an important milestone this evening with this bill, the passage and hopefully the enactment of legislation that the state has been waiting for a long time, too long. This comprehensive transportation package is the result of hard work, negotiation, and collaboration among a necessarily diverse group of transportation stakeholders. It is also, more recently, the result of the commitment and hard work of a group of legislators, most of whom are on the dais this evening, dedicated to putting together a bill that finally brings long-term sustainability to the state's transportation system. The League of Oregon Cities has been pleased to be a part of these discussions from the outset and looks forward to continuing to be a partner as House Bill 2001 continues its journey. I won't say odyssey. Somebody already did that.
And he stole it from me, and I'm very upset about that, by the way.
And as the projects and policies that it contemplates come to fruition. The League's goal from the beginning of the session has been to be helpful in the passage of legislation that makes a significant down payment on the growing gap between what cities have and what they need to maintain their local transportation systems. A bill that strengthens the partnership between ODOT and its local government partners, and that maintains the ability of local governments to provide for themselves as necessary. Further, in addressing the transportation system's traditional financial needs, we've been supportive all along of the visionary thinking in terms of new ways to manage that system in order to ensure its sustainability, both financially or economically and environmentally. House Bill 2001 in its current form substantially does all of that, and to quote from testimony that I offered when this bill was in its infancy, the League remains generally supportive of its content. Like everybody in this room, or who was in the room, there is stuff in this bill which we like, and there's stuff in this bill which we don't like. And make no mistake, some of the stuff that's in this bill that we don't like cuts to the very core of principles of local government. Obviously, I'm referring to the preemption, the four-year preemption, and the concern that we would have about the vote requirement coming out of that preemption, a tool which I've said before and will say again tonight, is available to cities and is available to anyone who chooses to use it as a matter of policy or a political tactic. Nevertheless, it is the intent of the League of Oregon Cities to work to keep this bill on track, both in terms of passage in this building and to enactment into law in its entirety. These times call for just this kind of legislation, a bill to reverse continuing disinvestment in an aging transportation infrastructure to create jobs during the worst economy that this state has known in decades, and to validate the work of a transportation partnership that is going to be called upon again in the future to continue to address the transportation needs of Oregon. Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chairs, members of the Special Joint Committee on Transportation, House Bill 2001 is a good. I'm not going to say it's great, but it's a good bill, and we urge its passage to the floor of both houses. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Brenda. Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Governmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and I will keep this brief given the lateness of the day. Along with the League of Oregon Cities, I'll try to make our position clear. The City of Eugene is supportive of most of this package, and we have concerns with the rest. And the rest of that package is what I'll limit my testimony to, although I would like to say that I appreciate all of the work that has been put into this package, and we are certainly appreciative of the funding allocation and very much appreciative of the funding that will go towards multimodal transportation. And we are grateful that two projects from our region are included in this package, so thank you for that. Now on to our concerns. The City of Eugene is concerned with the wording of Section 25, the moratorium on the collection of local gas taxes. This particular provision, as drafted, does not adequately protect the City of Eugene's gas tax that we currently have. And we would ask that you consider allowing local governments to, for the moratorium on local governments, to allow for the continued collection of a gas tax at a rate that currently exists or existed at the date of the effective date of the bill. And so that's what we would ask for that. On to the MPO planning, as you can imagine. We do have concerns. The City of Eugene is very supportive of the concept and the goals behind these provisions. We absolutely support the goal of achieving reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And as Chair Beyer mentioned earlier, the City of Eugene, as you can imagine, has taken numerous steps on many fronts to address climate change. The City of Eugene City Council is about to review and hopefully adopt a climate change initiative, which is very, very progressive. For instance, one of the provisions is a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050, which is very, very progressive. I have to say I don't know how the City of Springfield feels about that, but the City of Eugene is certainly looking at that. just to acknowledge that. We are doing what we can to move forward to address climate change, not only because we know we need to. It's because the City of Eugene wants to. And although these are laudable goals, we would like to be successful in achieving greenhouse gas reductions, and we do not believe that the provisions as set out in this bill will allow us to be successful in those. We would like to have a model, as the Chair stated earlier, that fits our particular region. As you know, we are about to split our UGB from Springfield, and we believe that some of these provisions do not adequately take that into consideration. We also note that Metro, and we're very appreciative of the fact that they it's suggested that they share what they learn from their journey down this road, and they certainly have more funding, more technical expertise, and more capacity to develop this type of planning and this type of modeling. We do not have such capacity in technical expertise in our region. The bill as drafted has a provision in it that allows Metro not to proceed if they are not adequately reimbursed for their efforts in developing a particular scenario and choosing one of those. That similar provision does not exist for the Eugene-Springfield area, even though we do not have similar capacity or technical expertise or funding. So we would request that you consider providing Springfield and Eugene the same consideration, that if we do not have the funding available to us, the provision that's provided to Metro under this bill is also provided to the City of Eugene and Springfield in our region to be able to not move forward if we don't have the funding available. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies, committee, for asking a question. I know you all want to leave.
I just like to dig down a tiny bit on your comment about MPO language that fits your region, because it sounded to me like the concerns that you have are with a regional policy limiting the city of Eugene's capacity to move forward with its own goals, and laudable goals they are. But what I think some of us really care about as well is the entire travel shed and making sure that we're planning for the region. So can I ask, and you know, this is well beyond what we're going to do here, but I do believe that we're going to move forward, hopefully, with this policy and further incarnations of it. And I'm just wondering if the city of Eugene has thought of what a different regional policy would look like. And I'm hoping the answer isn't that we would like to hit our 80% goal and not have to deal with any of our neighbors. So given that that's not an adequate answer for me, I'm wondering if you have an answer that actually talks about a regional approach to planning transportation and land use together towards the objective of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, something that we might not have thought of.
Chair Beyer, Representative Call, yes, I don't know if it would be an adequate response, but it's not so much that the city of Eugene would like to achieve its 80% goal and not take its neighbors into consideration. I think it's more that we would like to take our neighbors into consideration in the goals that we would like to achieve. One of the issues that we do have in our region is agreeing what is best for our region, and because we're the big city in the region, we certainly don't want to come across as coming up with a plan that the rest of our region has to comply with as well, because it might not be what's best for them. We'd like to set up a model where we can work cooperatively with the city of Springfield and the rest of our region to come up with a solution and goals that work for our region. So it's really a modified local control, but we want to be successful, and we know we can't be successful if we can't work together with our partners.
Madam Chair, if I might follow up. Thank you. And is it your sense that within the Eugene Springfield area, within that MPO, that a regional governmental body is something that's not tenable, or even giving an MPO significant power towards effectuating planning decisions within the city level, that's something that just would not be acceptable to the local jurisdictions? You can feel free not to answer me.
No, Chair by Representative Call, it's not that it's not acceptable. It's that in our particular region, it hasn't always worked like we had hoped.
I'm done, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Because these people would like to leave tonight.
I was going to suggest these two could join me for a beer after this, and we could talk about it till the cows come home.
Would that be a 16-ounce beer?
You'd have to buy.
Hey, let's go.
Thank you for coming. And that was the last person to sign up, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2001A, and we are adjourned.